Okay, this is interviewing Bernie Burke at Leiden on 21st January, 1972. Well then, how did you get started in radio astronomy?
Well, Taffy Bowen was an old friend of several of the senior people at MIT where I was graduating. And Al Hill saw him at some meeting around probably 1952 or so. And he hadn't heard the radio astronomy story, and Taffy, of course, was full of it right at that time. So he invited Taffy to go to MIT to give a series of three lectures on all of radio astronomy.
Yeah.
And the first lecture was on the sun, and the second lecture was on the moon, and the third one was on everything else. And Hill's hope was to get some of the faculty at MIT interested in radio astronomy. Well,
now who is Hill?
He's a professor of physics. At the moment he's vice president for research at MIT, but he's a former member of PSAC. He's been very active on the national scene. He was one of the active people in the Rad Lab. And so the irony was that of all the people who heard the lecture, I think I was the only one that the message came through to. And so when I was looking around for a job after finishing all my work, which was on...
What was your thesis on?
Zeeman effect in water. Zeeman effect in asymmetric... Zeeman effect in molecules, and in particular the water molecule, it's a nuclear moment measurements also. But it was microwave spectroscopy. And it was Henry Booker suggested I go to the Carnegie Institution. And Tuve had just heard from Minkowski about the discovery of the identification of radio sources a year or so earlier. And so...
And Tuve's position was what?
He was director of the
DTM.
Head of the DTM. And so he invited Graham Smith to come to the DTM, and Graham had arrived just a few months before I came, and so I essentially learned radio astronomy from Graham. And the first experiment that Graham was involved in was a 38 megahertz interferometer to just start measuring scintillations. And during the course of the year, there was a stewing about what should be the next step. And Graham felt that low-frequency radio astronomy would be the right thing to do because he knew that the sunspot minimum was coming on, and it was something you could do with string and sealing wax techniques, which was...
This is the same Graham Smith that that John Alton.
Right. Yeah, he was at the Cavendish at that time. So the proposal was to build a 22 megahertz Niels Cross. No, he didn't.
Right.
We built it as an X, and it was clear Graham was the main driving force. That is, as things got on, I got involved more in the working along with him. But this Graham was the one who thought that this was the next direction to go. And I remember too wondering if a prototype should be built, and Graham was pretty quick in his answer that he should build the whole thing as a prototype. So, anyway, we had built a 22 megahertz interferometer, which was intended to observe the occultation of the Crab Nebula by the sun in the spring of 54. I came to the Carnegie Institution in the fall of 53. And so in the spring of 54...
Are all these things located in the district?
The antenna field was about 20 miles up the Potomac River on a piece of bottomland down beside the river. And we rented a 96-acre field to build antennas in. Originally, we rented a smaller field next to it. So we built the small interferometer, and during the course of the occultation of the crab, we suddenly saw what appeared to be a reappearance of the crab nebula. Very bright, beautiful fringes. And in looking over the data, Graham was this.
Okay.
Well, let's see, where were we? Oh, yes. Graham saw this, and it was amusing. That is, he pounced on it right away, and the two of us got down on the floor measuring up the fringes, and from the fringe rate and from the rate of change of the fringe rate, Graham saw that it was not right at the position of the sun or of the position of the Crab Nebula, and he said, oh, that's interesting. He had heard that Shane in Australia had seen bursts from the sun, but rather far out from the sun itself. It ended up being 10 diameters away, so rather large amount. And it rested there. That was the end of the discussion.
Yeah.
And so we went on to build the antenna. And Graham left in the, I think it was at the end of the summer of 54. And the antenna was about completed by the time he left. But we continued to work on cleaning up the details and starting observing. And we really got going on a regular observing program about the turn of the year, 54, 55, as the antenna was really working. We decided to look at the Crab Nebula because we got a nice trace in the crab. And
where was this first occultation published? Or was it?
They mean the first interferometer?
Yeah.
Measurement of the apparent burst
yes,
in the sun.
Right.
That wasn't published. It was just, an interesting thing. Well, at any rate, we looked at the crab, and there were a number of other weaker sources on the tracing. We could see IC443. Then there was another source that was apparently weak and extended, but was interfered with. And we looked several times, and several times the interference came just as we were trying to look at that weak third source that was just beyond IC443. Was it IC443? No, I think it was. I think it was IC. Anyway, we then proceeded to just make a systematic survey. Ken Franklin had come there in the fall of 1954 and was working. And we were submitting a paper to the Princeton meeting in 1955 with the WAS. And we were working up the data, that is, we as usual. We knew we had the observations. We had flux measurements of several radio sources and maybe the large 22 megahertz Hills Cross. And so we had all the records laid out. And in laying them out with the Crab Nebula lining up, so you essentially had it laid out by sidereal time, you could see that this interfering set of bursts was also coming through. At first you could see it was approximately the same sidereal time. Clearly not solar time.
Yeah.
Approximately the same sidereal time. And I think Ken Franklin has written a story in the Scientific American. It's a very accurate story because I noticed that they were coming by at about the same time. And then we began to fiddle and fuss as to what it could be. And trying to measure the very best time, we could see that it wasn't coming quite the same sidereal time. And there's an ironic thing. We don't remember who it was who made the suggestion. That is, whether it was one of us or whether it was just someone half-joking in the room, because it was the large map room, Howard Tatel, John Farrer, at least those two were also
there. In the basement
there.
Of the...
At that time, it was on the first floor. It was the arrangement. And the detail is different from that. And at any rate, somebody suggested, well, why not look up the planets? And so there was a certain amount of laughter, but we did it anyway. And very quickly we could see that Jupiter was in the vicinity. And then Ken Franklin sat down and plotted out the time when the nose bursts came and the position of Jupiter. And he said, "Hey, fellas, come on over here and look at this." And you can just see it, you know, there it
is. Yeah. No doubt about it.
And so it sort of just gradually grew up. It's funny, we don't really know who it was that originally thought it might be Jupiter.
About when is this article in Scientific American? Just roughly?
About 5 years ago, plus or minus 1 year. Then I went back to the interferometer records where we'd seen the burst far out from the sun.
Yeah.
And, of course, the position one deduced from the fringe rate plus the rate of change of fringe rate was right on Jupiter's location at that time. So,
So you recorded this at the AAS meeting, right?
Yeah. It was only a week later.
Oh, I see. So you had no chance to follow it up, huh?
No. And, let's see,
Does the official abstract of that paper show anything about Jupiter?
The official abstract doesn't show anything about Jupiter.
Right, yeah.
It just says we've examined some radio sources.
Yeah. What about, I forget, some Australian fellow you mentioned that had seen a burst.
Shane.
Was this shown to be Jupiter?
Yeah. And actually, we let the Australians know. I wrote a letter to Shane. And by the time I got to the Manchester Symposium of the IAU, that summer, the Australians had worked out their data, and they got a rotation period, so that it was a source located in System 2. They had the wrong identification and the wrong rotation period by a small amount, but still the basic thing was that it was not rotating with the equatorial velocity. And I remember going back into the literature just for the fun of it. Shane, just a short time before, had published a 9 megahertz survey, and in his publication of the 9 megahertz survey, he commented that they did have trouble with interference from time to time, and he showed an example of a typical interference burst. And son of a gun, that typical interference burst occurred when Jupiter was high in the sky overhead. And of course, it might have been interference, but it's also a good chance that it was.
Now, this follow-up work the Australians did, was this just from looking at past
just
records?
Looking at their own records.
I see.
And
when they were setting the sun.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, then we built a proper interferometer, and several different groups came almost at the same time to showing that there was a well-defined rotation period, different from the Australian rotation period, but not greatly different, the so-called System 3. Roger Gallet was the first person to officially call it System 3, but I think Gallet and Smith and Alex Smith and Ken Franklin and I, all of us, had the data in hand and knew that we all had a value for the rotation period, which was roughly 9 hours, 55 minutes, 29 seconds. We all had the answer. And after a while, well, let's see, our observations, we showed that there was high circuit polarization. And then as time went on, it just became clear to me that it was going to be a problem that we'd seen the main features. But really showing what it was, it wasn't clear that it was the place to spend the rest of his life. And just about that time, Howard Tatel died, and he'd been working on the hydrogen line receiver at the DTM. So essentially John Farrer and I had to join to make that receiver work. And so that meant a turn to galactic radio astronomy. We were the first to use the 21 centimeter line receiver on the Green Bank 300 foot when we looked at.
On the 300 foot.
Yeah.
But
we put a traveling feed. We made a traveling feed. Everett Eklund at the DTM was a very good engineer. We built a traveling feed and we surveyed the major axis of M31.
This was when, in 55?
No, this is, that would be later. It would be around 1960.
Oh, that's right. The 300 foot wasn't even around.
Around 1960.
Around 1960.
I forget the exact year. You'd have to sort of work it back.
But let me just ask now, what about the 60 foot dish? Wasn't the 60 at the Carnegie?
Yes, yeah.
That was what Tatel's receivers went on. Where did that dish come from?
That was by the Carnegie Institution from Blount Knox. Originally, we wanted an 84 foot, but it turned out we didn't have enough money for an 84 foot, so we had a 60 foot instead.
And designed mainly for hydrogen line?
Well, it was. You see, the Blount Knox dish was essentially originally Tatel and Tuve. That is, Tatel and Tuve worked out a design. The reason they made a new design was that they thought the Kennedy dish was too expensive and thought they could do it cheaper. And so the idea of just using a very big gear that was not too precise was theirs. They then had a local engineer make a first engineering study, and then they went to D.S. Kennedy and said, well, here's a dish, but we think it ought to be made out of steel. And D.S. Kennedy, they made a mistake. They said, well, we don't build things of steel. Aluminum is our specialty, but why don't you see it at the Blount Knox Company? Later, they wished they'd gone into the steel business. So anyway, then Blount Knox re-engineered the dish. Bob Hall was a very good engineer, and Tatel resonated with him.
So this receiver was tested out on the 60 foot.
Yeah.
And then you used it.
We had it in a trailer. We had it in a trailer, and we hauled it by trailer down the 300 foot.
And that was that the first line observations you're saying on the 300 foot?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Now let's see. What else is there? Well,
Just describe that survey again, because
I guess it's... Let's see, we got to 60 to 63 was hydrogen line work, but then it was around 1963, more or less, that we Nordvik symposium.
It's in the Nordvik?
Nordvik.
Yeah, in 66.
We reported the results in 66, but the work had been done a little bit earlier. Here we go. Shouldn't have turned your machine on so quickly. Here we go. Does it give the date? Isn't that funny? It doesn't give the date. At any rate, the main conclusion, there not being any halo, is that there. I think the work was done in 64.
Uh-huh.
63 or 64.
So you cover the complete sky above minus 19 declination.
Yeah. And it's actually very close to being finished, but it's been handed to a succession of graduate students. It's all on tape. It has, the job of editing this massive thing, correcting it, calibrating it, it progresses by a finite step each time. That is, the first pass was done by Ted Reifenstein. The second improvement, or the second development, was Martin Ewing. Waiting for a graduate student.
Each grad student went on to something that he thought was more interesting.
Well, it's clear why that went on, because it wasn't a thesis, you see. Right. It was cleaning up somebody else's work.
Right.
Well, anyway, that was it was good fun, because nobody before that had proposed driving the 300 foot up and down, swabbing the sky. We took 40 degree cuts with the antenna, and
zigzagging. Well, that's actually sort of how Westerhout surveyed.
Yeah, Westerhout began to do this afterwards. Yeah,
over a much smaller region.
Yeah, and at the same time at the Carnegie Institution, then we decided to build a cheap interferometer using a home-built dish, a 100-foot dish. And we built a 100-foot dish near Durwood. It was to be used as an interferometer with a 60-foot. But then I left before the job was done and went to MIT.
Did it ever... I don't think it ever did get done, did it?
The dish itself was completed, but not much in the way of observations were done with it because the staff, the radio astronomy staff, had dropped below the critical, the critical level. Ken Turner was still there, but he had the Carnegie Institution also had started the Argentina project. Argentine dish was the same design. Actually, we used the dish that we built in Maryland. In part, we used it as a prototype. We could work out the same things that would be done in South America, but under much more difficult conditions.
Now, can you tell me a little bit about that dish? I mean, was it just to get a look at the southern sky, I suppose?
Yeah, sure. Look at the Magellanic Clouds. The reason it went to Argentina was very clear that the Carnegie Institution didn't want to have an all-American show where essentially you go in, clean up, and pull out. They wanted to build a real partnership. And it was pretty clear that Argentina was the only South American country that had the scientific competence to hold up their own end. And so a corporation or a group was set up that had three representatives, the University of La Plata, the University of Buenos Aires, and the Carnegie Institution, which meant that it had a majority of Argentinians in terms of the representation on the steering council. And the dish, it remained technically American property, but that was just to provide a little extra protection for the Argentinians. And actually, I did go down there to help get it on the air, because the Argentinians did most of the work, but Ken Turner and I also worked on the thing to try to help bring it into operation. Yeah. So I went to MIT, and then at MIT, the major amount of really active work was on developing line interferometry. Got started very early with Alan Rogers doing the massive amount of real hard work on getting the millstone haystack antennas working as an interferometer on the OH line. And there, it was I was the pusher and Al Rogers the doer. That was a funny exercise because on the one hand, Lincoln Lab did want to do the job, but they had a very cautious view of how fast they should go. And I kept jumping up and down because I knew that Caltech was also doing interferometry on the OH line.
In fact, you did do it first.
We published simultaneously, and I don't know who actually got fringes first. That is, our publications appear at the same time.
Oh, I don't remember this. I'm familiar with your group's paper.
Yeah, this was Raymond and...
Elias Hall?
No, this was earlier than that. This was... who was it? I forget the authors, but...
Not Bartlett.
No. You'd have to look it up. That is a... We published in the Astrophysical Journal around 1960...
Yeah. But you mean simultaneously in the same journal?
In the same journal.
But
what happened is we called them up and we said, well, we're not going to tell you our answer, but we'll publish our results to see if they agree. And then that was the beginning of Chase. That's the thing that ended our going into long baseline interferometry, because we kept going to bigger baselines. The next step beyond the... short one from millstone to haystack was to go to the Harvard antenna at Agassiz Station, which is 10 miles away. And there, essentially, we used a radio link. And then it was in the winter of 1967, I think, that the idea was bubbling around that a long baseline experiment should be done. And
line experiment, you mean?
On the OH line.
Yeah.
On the OH line.
The continuum had
The continuum, what happened was at that time, since we had been using Greenbank, both for that and for things that other people, as we were also getting involved in recombination line work with Greenbank at the same time, we knew that there was a VLB project going on, and we also knew that they weren't getting any results. And so in the winter time, I just decided that perhaps the right way to do long baseline interferometry was to use a line where your correlation time would be longer. And so I talked to the Greenbank people about it. I said, well, we realize we're late comers, but we think that this is the way to do a VLBI experiment, to do it right the first time and really debug your system on something that's easy to observe.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it served as a marvelous spur, I think, because we scheduled an observation for, when was it? I think it was about the 1st of June. I've forgotten the exact dates, you can check on it.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
As I remember, it was the 1st of June. However, the up until then, how's your tape going? Too talkative?
Oh, no. I just have to, there's no indication when it ends.
Oh, I see.
I wish I had a bell or something.
Yeah.
Well,
the up until that time, it had been between Arecibo and the 140-foot that the Cornell NRAO group were trying to do the job. However, they wanted to have one last fling before we came in. It was quite clear, you know, they really did want to have...
On the 140-foot.
Yeah. So they worked up an experiment between the 140-foot and Maryland Point. And so that was done about May 15th, about 2 weeks before the...
This is 65, right?
67. And they got fringes on a quasar there. So I think it was probably a good thing. That is, they'd done all the hard work, so they got the first fringes. Then they brought... our original proposal was that we use the Haystack computer as one terminal and use only one of the Mark I VLBI terminals, the one at 140-foot. However, at this stage, Marshall Cohen wanted very much to share the time on Haystack, but using one of the other two Mark I terminals at Haystack. Well, we had a certain amount of hassle over that because I was feeling very worried. I knew it was a complicated experiment, and I said, well, I think that to have two really complicated pieces of digital equipment in the same room, I'm afraid they'll be talking to each other. But it ended up with, I think, Paul Sebring and Dave Heeshan agreeing that it probably wouldn't be a big risk. So we shared the time on the telescopes. And the only change that was made was that the other group observed observed quasars with a wider band, whereas we had two bandwidths. We had 120 kilohertz and a 6 kilohertz bandwidth.
Right.
So we
they were the same front end, though.
No, they used the same front end. So then the experiment worked. It was one of those. I remember exactly the moment when it worked because. I had gone down to Greenbank. I started off the experiment at Haystack. I had gone to Greenbank, and I came back from Greenbank carrying a tape with me. And it was a tape that was taken at the last minute. Jim Moran was, at this stage, Jim Moran was the man really deepest involved in the nitty-gritty. And Jim had been trying to process some of the earlier tapes and wasn't getting any results. And so one of the last tapes we took at Greenbank was an observation of W3 at the zero fringe rate point. See, when you have zero fringe rate, then you don't have to worry about correcting for your fringes, because everything is very straightforward. And so we had one tape taken at the zero fringe rate point, and I came back with that. And it was really wonderful because Jim had been processing other tapes and nothing was coming out. And so he put that tape on, and it worked very quickly. I was about to go because because this is on the computer
at any second.
Yeah. And then Jim said, "Hey, come back here and look at this." And went back, and there was as nice a line as you could want.
What had been the problem?
It turned out it was a software problem where the fringe rate had been put into the wrong sign.
Uh-huh.
And so going to the zero fringe rate was just the right way to escape the...
A likely thing, yeah.
Yeah. So, and then after that it went very quickly because, you know, the nature of software is once you fix software, it's really fixed.
Yeah.
It never goes bad. And so, very quickly then, Jim was able to find out what his error was.
Four stations.
I'll give it 5 or 6 seconds to the leader here. Okay, this is continuing with Bernie Burke, and we're talking about the OHVLBI. You were saying four station probably is difficult, just mainly because of scheduling, the people and antennas. So.
Yeah, oh, that is the